Thank you, BC.
Court is ready to hear argument from Relator in Aetna versus Specia.
May it please the court, Ms. Carol Jensen will present argument for the Relator. She has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
One of the two judges who is the respondent here is no longer on the bench, is that?
That's correct, Your Honor, and we plan to file a notice of substitution of parties and substitute Honorable David Birchelman, who is now the presiding judge of 37th Court. May it please the court, my name is Carol Jensen, and David Jones and I are here today on behalf of the Relator Sanger thing at the Casualty Insurance Company. This is a fraud case arising out of payment of a claim under an insurance policy issued by Aetna and sold to the insured by the real party in interest Sanger and Altgeld Insurance Agency. In the suit, Aetna is contending that is the real party's fraudulent acts caused it to pay a $4.5 million claim that it does not owe under the terms of the policy. We're here before this court today on a mandamus proceeding arising out of Sanger and Altgeld's motion to enforce sanctions that had been imposed against Aetna in a previous suit. In the earlier suit, Judge Specia struck all of Aetna's witnesses, fact and expert, under Rule 215.5. The fact witnesses were stricken because Aetna had not provided telephone numbers and a description of knowledge of the witnesses. What's important to note is that the 24 fact witnesses had also been identified by Sanger and Altgeld in their answers to interrogatories. Most, if not all, had been deposed more than one occasion. The two expert witnesses were identified in a supplemental response that was filed within the 30 days before trial. There had been no motion to compel, and there was no evidence of any surprise or prejudice to Sanger and Altgeld. Judge Specia struck the witnesses 10 days before trial, and seeing no alternative, Aetna filed a motion for non-suit, even though that meant the sacrifice of its causes of action subject to a 2-year statute of limitations, and the case was dismissed without prejudice.
I want to be sure that I understand the basis for the original order. It was that your experts were late in being designated?
That's correct, Your Honor. And Mr. Jones, in the trial court, made a showing of good cause on the record that was part of the record before this court.
And that showing was basically that they were hired late and had some difficulty obtaining an expert.
Yes, Your Honor.
And other than designating the experts late, the only other basis was that the telephone numbers were not provided?
That's correct. And the interrogatory also asked for a factual description of what the fact witnesses knew, which is...
And was that not answered, or was there a cross-reference to the depositions that had been taken?
That was... I don't believe there was any cross-reference, Your Honor.
What if instead of non-suiting, you had successfully argued a motion for continuance, which had continued the trial setting beyond the 30 days deadline for designating these witnesses?
I think that would have put us into a more appropriate area of sanctions. That was definitely an option that Judge Specia had before him. There was a motion for continuance pending at the time that this motion was argued. He was informed of that, and he chose not to reserve any ruling on this motion until after the motion for continuance was argued. And so, based on his representations at the hearing in making his ruling and striking all the witnesses, and his indication that there wasn't going to be another judge, another district judge down there who was going to act as an appellate court and override his decision, all indications were that was the order that Aetna was going to have to live with, that all of its witnesses had been struck.
Didn't you have an adequate remedy by appeal?
Not at that time, Your Honor. It's only been, at that time, sanctions were only, a mandamus relief was not available for sanctions at that point. If we had gone to trial, Aetna would have been in a position of trying to convince a trial court to put on 2 weeks of testimony in the form of a bill of exceptions, which is highly unlikely. At the time, the best remedy, it seemed, was to file the motion for non-suit and eliminate the effect of this interlocutory order based upon the well-established right to non-suit. And I'd like to add that there was
Excuse me, before you move on to another point, are you arguing that counsel can engage in the grossest kind of discovery abuse and then get sanctioned in order to insulate cells from that sanction, just to file a non-suit, to start over? Is that what you want us to do in an opinion?
I don't think that's the, I don't think that's warranted. I don't think that you have to go that far in addressing this case. I think certainly there are situations where a trial court makes a decision because of the conduct of counsel and the parties in the case that the case is without merit and imposes death penalty sanctions. And certainly in that circumstance, that has been well recognized to have res judicata effect in any later suit and would not be, that sanction would continue to be imposed, and it's a decision on the merits. In a circumstance where we have here, where death penalty sanctions in effect were imposed, but you didn't have any consideration of the merits as to the due process requirements of what were the party's involvement, you know, what was the cause of this, was this the result of a series of ongoing disputes between these parties, was there a flagrant violation of discovery, was there callous disregard? None of those considerations were taken in, you know, the judge didn't consider those things, and I think in this circumstance, imposing it in a later case is not proper.
Were any lesser sanctions imposed before the strike all the witnesses?
No, there was never a motion to compel file, so this was the first time that this question was before the court, and there wasn't a consideration of lesser sanctions.
Wouldn't it have been an option for the attorney who came in late in the case to seek an extension of time to do all these answers as opposed to just filing the answers and see if he got away with it?
That would be an option. And just so that it's clear for the record, Mr. Jones was the attorney of record on this file before this motion was made. Shortly before this, he started his own firm and became the actual handling attorney, so that that is clear in the record. He had been attorney of record on the file.
Okay, so I thought there was reference to coming on board 60 days before the trial.
That's right, Your Honor.
Actually, he was the attorney long before that.
He was the attorney of record, but not the handling attorney. When it was transferred to his own firm, he left the firm Fulbright and started his own firm, and at that time, he took on the handling of the file.
Is there any reason why exclusion of witnesses as a sanction should be treated any differently from other sanctions that might be available to the trial court, for example, assessment of costs and attorney's fees?
In terms of
which
whether...
Which could not be avoided by a non-suit. In other words, you're arguing that that you can avoid the sanction by non-suiting here, but presumably you'd agree that you could not if the trial judge assessed the fine.
I think there's a distinction to be drawn here, because if this court determined that you could never avoid a sanction order that had been imposed on you before a non-suit, wouldn't that carry over to have an effect on any other interlocutory ruling that had been made in the case? So if a motion for partial summary judgment had been granted or denied, either way, granted more particularly, and the case has then been non-suited, does that affect a final ruling on that issue so that if the case is refiled? I don't think so. In the case of monetary sanctions, where you've got attorney's fees or costs awarded, I think that's a distinct situation where a party is subject to the court's contempt power to have those sanctions enforced against them, and they remain in effect. When this case was non-suited, the sanctions dissolved with the case.
So do you agree that if Judge Specia had, instead of excluding witnesses, ordered this costs and attorney's fees in the amount of, say, $10,000, that you could not have avoided the payment of that that amount by non-suit?
I think that's correct. I mean, I think that under the recent case out of this court, the Felderhoff court case, this case held that was subject to appeal. And I think that a party who is in order to pay costs or ordered to pay attorney's fees, there may be a question of how do you go ahead and enforce that? Is that enforced by the contempt power? Is that enforced by the other party filing a motion to reinstate the case for the purpose of enforcing those sanctions within that same cause of action? But I think definitely if the court has ordered monetary sanctions, if attorney's fees are caused, that that's going to continue after non-suit to the extent that the court may have to grant a motion to reinstate to enforce it or use the contempt powers.
Why should that be different than the exclusion of witnesses?
Well, I think we've got to consider the effect of this sanction. If the sanction of attorney's fees had the effect of precluding the presentation of the merits, then that's a different situation than a nominal fee. And I think that that would kick it into the same kind of consideration and analysis that we're in this case.
Wouldn't that have mandated the pursuit of a mandamus on your client's part to try to turn around the what you contend to be an erroneous order in the first case?
Unfortunately, at that time, that was before the Transamerican decision and before this court recognized that sanctions could be, death penalty sanctions of this type could be reviewed by mandamus.
So you're saying your success was doubtful at that point? Any predictability of success?
Right. And the option of appeal at that point of going, playing out the scenario of why didn't we appeal, okay, we go to trial. Mr. Jones is unable to make any kind of opening statement because he can't state what's going to be in evidence because he's not going to be able to put on any evidence. You go to call your first witness, we'll dismiss the jury and put on 2 weeks of testimony and a bill of exception and try to establish good cause and harm from the error. It just, at that point, the most expedient route to get the trial on the merits was to file the non-suit, take the dismissal without prejudice, even though that meant the cost of the 2-year causes of action, and go forward with the trial on the merits of this case.
Counsel, focusing your attention on a later time in the proceedings we're concerned with here,
yes.
Was there a hearing actually conducted in August of this year on the motion for rehearing?
At that time, Your Honor, Judge Spezia recognized that this case was pending before this court, and he decided to wait until this court had resolved the issue before making any other ruling on the motion for summary judgment for this. I think that the important thing for this court to remember is there's got to be some authority for reimposing these sanctions. And what has been recognized in our case law traditionally is res judicata or collateral estoppel is the basis for holding a preclusive effect in a later suit, whether it's a legal issue that's determined or a factual issue. And the real parties in interest had the burden of meeting those requirements for res judicata. And in considering that, we're bound by the due process concerns and the concerns set out in Transamerican to make sure that what happened here, where a death penalty was imposed for a misdemeanor offense, that's not what the rules are intended to do. And that's a violation of due process and the concerns set out in Transamerican.
I'm a little bit curious. Excuse me, Ms. Simpson. There's a motion for summary judgment pending.
That's
in the trial
correct.
Court, isn't there? Does this ruling of the court preclude you from presenting affidavits?
At this time, that was the basis for the motion for reconsideration of the ruling on the summary judgment. Judge Spezia had earlier denied this real party in interest motion for summary judgment. They filed a motion for reconsideration saying we would be unable to present any evidence. So indication at this last hearing was that if this court decided that, in fact, our witnesses were excluded or decided not to decide the issue at this time, that Judge Spezia would grant their motion for summary judgment, and we're going to be here on appeal deciding this issue.
Seems on the summary judgment, to do that, you don't have to have any declaration on interrogatories before a summary judgment affidavit is presented. I don't know.
I think the basis of Sanger and Altgeld's position is because we've been precluded, the court has entered an order that precludes us from presenting any fact witnesses or expert witnesses, and so there's no way that we can provide controverting affidavits. And so we would be unable to controvert any evidence that they would put on. And the indication from Judge Spezia was he would be granting that motion if it came back down to him.
So it's your position that the non-suit wiped the slate clean. Why shouldn't we consider whether the sanctions were appropriate in the first instance under Transamerica?
Why should you not look at the underlying order?
If we disagree that the non-suit wipes the slate clean, why shouldn't we look at the appropriateness of the exclusion of witnesses under Transamerica in the first case?
Well, I think we have to consider the effect of Rule 215.5 and whether the sanctions are appropriate under an arbitrary operation of 215.5 doesn't necessarily satisfy the requirements of Transamerican and due process. The way that Rule 215.5 has been interpreted and the discretion of the trial court has been so narrowed on good cause, it's our position that, in effect, there isn't a good cause exception, and Rule 215.5 doesn't allow the types of inquiry required by due process and required by Transamerican. There's no consider the trial court.
Aren't you familiar with our Miller versus Bynum and the Southwest Feed Yard case where the court, in fact, did find good cause?
Very narrow circumstances, though. And the effect, very narrow circumstances that don't necessarily apply in this case, but even looking at this case, we've had an operation of a rule 2 weeks before trial, after full discovery has occurred, after there's no allegation of any kind of prejudice whatsoever. The operation of that rule has precluded the presentation of the merits in any form or fashion.
When you say there was full discovery prior to the sanction order, you're saying all this, experts that were identified late were deposed?
No, I was referring to the fact witnesses. But there would have been under either of the other paragraphs under 215, there would have been lesser sanctions available that could have addressed that.
And who filed a motion for continuance?
We did.
And the court refused to act on the motion?
The motion for continuance was pending at the time that the court heard this motion for sanctions, and the court would not reserve the ruling until after that motion for continuance. The non-suit was filed before the motion for continuance was heard because of the timing of it.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Jonathan Powersey will present argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Jonathan Powerstein for the Real Party and Interest, Sanger and Althea Insurance Agency. And with me is Mr. John McCamish. Your Honors, the issue in this case is whether plaintiffs have a power not shared by defendants to evade properly imposed sanctions by taking a non-suit on a Friday and on Monday morning refiling the same case, thereby allegedly freeing themselves from a sanctions order.
Well, the use of non-suit, of course, has been pretty unrestricted in the past, hasn't it?
Justice Doggett, the use of a non-suit has been unrestricted in the sense that plaintiffs have not been forced to continue a case after they've desired to stop pursuing it and been allowed to non-suit. However, the cases Renfro versus Johnson and others make it clear that things that happened prior to that non-suit can be given an effect if the plaintiff then tries to refile his case.
If opposing counsel, for example, when he ascertained some difficulty in finding an expert, had decided that he was not going to be able to get an expert in time for trial and had chosen to non-suit at that point, there wouldn't have been any basis for today's action, would
there? Your Honor, I think that's correct. Had they non-suited prior to suffering a sanction for their discovery abuse, there would be no order to enforce in a later case, no public policy implications in the effectiveness of valid court orders. However,
likewise, if they, instead of moving earlier than they did, if they waited until a later time, and you had made objection at the time that they tried to put on the first witness, that this witness telephone number hadn't been disclosed, or that this witness hadn't been identified 30 days before trial, and the judge sustained that objection, they could have moved for a non-suit at that time.
Your Honor, are you assuming a trial objection without a prior sanctions
yes.
order? Frankly, I don't know. I believe in that case that had there simply been a trial objection and no sanctions order, no Rule 215.5
right.
implications, perhaps they could have non-suited at that stage. That's
well,
not what happened.
Whether in between here, based on what actually happened, they had a right to non-suit. And I guess my question to you about that is, what purpose is served by denying them a right to non-suit at that point without prejudice to putting on witnesses that you have months to learn about?
Well, I'd answer that in two ways. First, they have not been denied the right to non-suit. They were allowed to non-suit their case and were not forced to proceed through a trial. On the second hand, the purpose that is served by enforcing the sanctions order is that it furthers the purposes underlying Rule 215.5, which is, number one, to ensure compliance, number two, to deter future violations, and number three, to avoid needless delay in cases. And this court had held in the past, and other courts have held, that the plaintiff was not entitled to force, or a defendant was not entitled to force a continuance upon the opposing party when it had failed to answer interrogatories in a timely manner. And in effect, that's exactly what they've done. If they can not answer the interrogatories, wait and see if anyone calls them to task for it, and then take a non-suit, refile the same case, they've forced a continuance that they shouldn't have been able to force, they've subverted the policies underlying the rule, and basically not suffered for their noncompliance.
If the trial court had granted a continuance, should the sanctions order then continue in effect?
Your Honor, I think that's an interesting question. Something to be noted is that at the hearing, and the record is in the transcript, at the hearing on the sanctions motion, the question was asked of Judge Spezia whether if a continuance was granted, the sanctions would remain in effect. And he left that question open for the monitoring judge, which in Bexar County is our judge who hears continuance motions. Unfortunately, we were deprived of the opportunity to answer that question because Aetna chose to try to escape the order by taking a non-suit. So we'll never know what would have happened had we had a hearing on their continuance motion.
What's your view?
Your Honor, my view on it is, I think there is some suggestion in this court's opinion in Alvarado that perhaps a continuance is an alternative to striking all the witnesses. Frankly, I don't know whether that really serves the purposes of Rule 215.5, which is to ensure that when you have a trial date, witnesses are fully disclosed in a timely fashion.
If that is permissible, if there is a continuance and the sanctions order then no longer is in effect, what's the difference in the non-suit?
I think, Your Honor, first the difference in the non-suit is that it arrogates to the party rather than the courts the power to control the effectiveness of that order. We have a party saying, all right, Judge, you've sanctioned me. You've indicated perhaps I'm not going to get a continuance. I'm just going to non-suit and start over and grant myself that continuance and vacate your order. And I don't believe that the law can allow litigants to subvert the courts, to supplant the courts, and decide what orders are going to be effective and what orders are not.
If we look at that sanction order on the Transamerica standard, do you think the punishment fits a crime or that the sanction was just under the circumstances of this case?
Yes, Your Honor, I absolutely do.
Tell me about it.
Despite their protestations, Your Honor, this was not even a close case under Rule 215.5. They totally ignored the interrogatory asking if they described the knowledge held by witnesses with knowledge of relevant
facts. Under what authority are you able to ask that question?
Your Honor, I believe we're entitled to ask the question under Rule 166B, and as I read this court's December 16th denial of the writ in the Housing Authority versus Rodriguez-Yepes case, the court did not approve the portion of that case saying that you can't ask that in an interrogatory. Furthermore, when no one objects under Alvarado and Gutierrez against the Dallas School District, you've got to answer the question, even if it's improper.
Would Judge Spezia have been warranted in Aetna 1 in dismissing the Aetna's lawsuit with prejudice as a sanction?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Rule 215.5 expressly states that the sanction is exclusion of the evidence the offending party has concealed.
Isn't this effectively that same thing?
Your Honor, I don't believe that it's the same thing as entering a sanction that you don't have any authority to enter because the rules don't speak to it. The rule here expressly provides an automatic sanction of exclusion of the witness. Now, had they answered as to the knowledge of some of the witnesses and not as others, he would have been authorized only to exclude the ones they didn't answer as to. Now, the practical effect of it may be that it precludes Aetna from presenting their case, but it's not an order dismissing their case with prejudice.
Why couldn't... What rationale would prohibit Aetna from just calling all the witnesses that you said, I mean, they basically said you mentioned all of them anyway. What would preclude them from calling those witnesses that you disclosed that had knowledge of all the facts that you had in your own information from being their witnesses at the time of trial?
Mr. Sinek, I believe that would subvert Rule 215.5, which is designed to ensure that a party answer interrogatories. If my compliance with the discovery rules can excuse their noncompliance, then the rule basically means nothing. And if I, they can call my experts.
The rule is to disclose to each side, and you demonstrate you already have the information, and what is served by telling the other side because they didn't duplicate the information, they now can't call those people to.
What is served?
How does that serve the disclosure aspect of discovery?
Well, that aspect alone perhaps would be served, but the purpose of ensuring compliance with the rules by litigants would not be served if you allow them to disregard an interrogatory and then just say, well, that's okay because the other side didn't disregard it.
They've suffered a penalty in as much as some of their claims are now barred by limitations. Isn't that, it's not totally without pain that they non-suited their client is?
In this case, that is correct, they have suffered some pain. However, the order that Judge Specia entered clearly prohibits them from calling the witnesses at trial of the cause. It is not limited to that case. The order, I think, is clear, and as was held in the Shine case, prohibits them from calling the witness at any trial. And the fact that they have lost some causes of action, you know, there's no rule that says the penalty is you lose some of your causes of action. I would submit that, you know, in Bexar County, we can often get a case to trial in 12 to 14 months. And if you had a plaintiff in an automobile case who did the same thing, you know, 12 months into the case, there would be no limitations bar, and he could refile the exact same case. So I don't think whether you look at whether he has some one cause of action is gone but one isn't, or all of them are gone or none of them are gone, I don't think should be determinative of whether or not a plaintiff can escape a sanction by non-suit. I would like to address couple of points now. One is the suggestion made below and here today to some extent that this was a case where a new lawyer came into the matter shortly before the trial. And the fact of the matter is Mr. Jones signed the original petition in the case, was the attorney of record, conducted depositions in the case during his tenure at Fulbright and Jaworski. And I am aware of no distinction in the law between a handling attorney and an attorney of record. This simply is not a case where there were new counsel coming into the case shortly before trial, thereby necessitating some sort of a delay. Their primary argument is that the trial court lacked jurisdiction to enter the order that it entered because they had non-suited. I think that's clearly wrong. There was jurisdiction without a doubt over the second case, Aetna 2. The trial court had the power under Section 21.001A of the Government Code to enforce its prior orders. I believe it also had ample inherent power under Eichelberger and Kozlos versus Mackey to enter an appropriate order to ensure the enforcement of its order in the prior case.
Transamerica and law enforcement Packer mandate that lesser sanctions be attempted, or any lesser sanctions attempted in this case are tried.
Your Honor, at the time that this case was decided, it was abundantly clear under this Court's many precedents that the only sanction under Rule 215.5 was exclusion of the witnesses. Now, we do not know, because Aetna chose to non-suit, whether a continuance might have been granted, and we might have had a later trial date, and they might have been allowed to call the witnesses. They did not choose to give the Court the opportunity to do that. They also did not choose to try to appeal or seek mandamus as to the order in Aetna 1. So we don't know whether they could have gotten it vacated on a mandamus or on an appeal. I think the reason for that is clear. When you review the record, they didn't approach a showing of good cause. They made just the sort of excuses this Court has repeatedly rejected in its opinions under Rule 215.5. And under those circumstances, there was not a lesser sanction for the Court to impose. The Court properly followed the rules as they were written and the past decisions of this Court. I also think it's important to note that the trial court did not abrogate Aetna's right to non-suit. Aetna was allowed to non-suit, and the absolute right to non-suit that they talk about is simply a right to not be forced to a trial that the plaintiff doesn't want to pursue, and it's a sound policy concern, I think motivated by concerns of judicial economy as much as anything else, that you not force a plaintiff into a trial that he doesn't want to go to. But there's never been a case holding that a plaintiff can use Rule 162 to escape discovery sanctions by taking a non-suit, turning right around and refiling the same case.
Assuming you're right, shouldn't we now evaluate the propriety of Judge Specia's order based on Transamerica's success now the law?
I don't believe so, Justice Cornyn, because it's final, it's unappealable. They didn't choose to try to attack the order when they could have. There's no basis in law to go back now and revisit that order that they chose not to appeal.
Well, he's reinstated in essence the same order in Aetna 2.
That's correct.
Why, what jurisdictional problem would there be for the court to address the propriety of that reinstatement in Aetna 2 of the previous order?
Well, I think, I think if we analogize to res judicata cases, you don't go back and retry the first case and the second case to decide whether or not the judgment in the first case was correct or not. You simply apply it in the second case. In any case, I think if we wanted to apply Transamerican and Braden to this order, I don't believe you'd come to a different result. The sanction in question was clearly the appropriate sanction under the rule. It wasn't excessive because it was a mandatory sanction, was that they exclude the witnesses.
What right-thinking American would go to trial when the trial court says you can't call any expert witnesses, you can't call any fact witnesses, but go on to trial? I mean, what, does that make sense to you?
Your Honor, I'm not suggesting they should have gone to trial. I'm suggesting that rather than trying to circumvent the order, they should have pursued a mandamus proceeding or an appeal from that order. And this court has held in Felderhoff that sanctions orders are appealable after a non-suit. They could have appealed it and tried to get it reversed on appeal and refiled their case. They could have done any number of things, rather than trying to choose a backdoor escape from a sanctions order. I think, Your Honor, that as a matter of policy, the proposition Aetna offers that a plaintiff, but not a defendant, can escape sanctions by non-suiting is wrong. If we accept their proposition, plaintiffs but not defendants can escape sanctions, Rule 215.5 sanctions will be undermined any time that all the plaintiff's causes of action are not barred by limitations. Plaintiffs will be encouraged to split causes of action, sue on some claims and not on others so that they can non-suit and start over if problems develop. Plaintiffs will be permitted to manipulate the rules, non-suit if they're called to task for what they've done, and the parties, not the courts, will control the effect of court orders. I submit that that's simply an untenable position. This sort of tactical gamesmanship should not be rewarded at all. Therefore,
about the use of a sanctions tort, should we sanction sanctions torts where you're barred in a death penalty situation from going to trial? No, but, and the game is you don't win on the merit. You win on discovery of problems. Is that where you want us to be?
Your Honor, I believe.
Do we need the jurisprudence of this state?
No, I believe the jurisprudence of this state should be, Your Honor, the litigants follow the rules, obey the rules, and obey the orders of the court, and don't hide discovery, refuse to make discovery, and then play games when called to task for it. That's what I believe the jurisprudence of the state should be. It is unfortunate, but nobody kept Aetna from answering these interrogatories. They were not prevented from finding experts. It's a big insurance company with lots of money. I really think they could have found some experts in time if they needed to. Fulbright and Jaworski had over 600 lawyers to go look for experts. I don't view this as an unfair sanction for what was done in this case.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Justice Gonzalez, I think that your point is well taken, that what happened in this case is just the type of gamesmanship that is not supposed to occur. Coming down 2 weeks before trial and seeking to have your opponent's witnesses struck because they haven't provided telephone numbers is the most critical.
If the interrogatory was objectionable, was it incumbent upon you to raise an objection to that interrogatory? And you did not do so.
Well,
therefore, had you waived under our case law, having you waived any objection to the form of the interrogatory?
I'm not sure that disposes of the question of whether the sanctions were proper under the circumstance. And there's a question, I think, under the Housing Authority of El Paso case about whether an objection has to be lodged to a question asking for knowledge of fact witnesses. There was no motion to compel filed in this case. There was no indication, no evidence, no allegation that they had any trouble whatsoever locating these factual witnesses. It's not a case where there were witnesses that appeared mysteriously at trial. All of them had been deposed. I'm talking about the fact witnesses. And I can see that there are problems with the expert witnesses.
But let's assume that there's all sorts of good reasons out there. What lesser sanction was available to trial courts imposed at trial court decided some sanction was available? What's a lesser sanction?
I think that it, in the posture of the case, the way it was before Judge Spezia the first time, that he had within his authority to reserve his ruling on that motion until after the motion for continuance had been ruled on, or on, or by his own authority to grant a motion for continuance.
How is that a sanction?
And
how is that a sanction?
Well, had he done that, then we move out of the 215.5 automatic sanctions into the other sanctions that are available under Rule 215 under paragraphs 2 and 3 that allow the trial court to focus the sanction in the way that Transamerica says, directed against the conduct that occurred, ordering attorney's fees for whatever costs might be required in deposing these experts, paying whatever additional costs they may have had in locating fact witnesses because we didn't provide telephone numbers. There were a lot of other sanctions that are available before you get to the point of imposing death penalty sanctions. So there were other sanctions available had Judge Fischer taken a different tack.
But those sanctions are not available unless the other party is sanctioned by not getting a trial set.
They were going to get their trial setting. It's just, it's moved back. If we move back a trial setting 30 days, how is that compared to striking a party's witnesses so that they are never able to present their case to a court and get a trial on the merits? I mean, okay, if that's a problem, then there's a lesser sanction. Pay the cost of whatever cost they're there.
You don't balance the competing interests unless you first back up the trial date.
I think under the way that Rule 215.5 was interpreted at that time, that was the option that Judge Spezia had. That he, that the way that the rule had been interpreted, I don't think that under that rule that he was justified in striking all of the fact witnesses under this court's authority in Smith versus Southwest Feed. This court has since then recognized that if there's information in the interrogatories that this is a party, Judge Spezia struck all the party witnesses as well, not just fact witnesses who were out there in all of these witnesses in deposed. So I think there's question about the order, the underlying order, even under the authority of this case.
There were multiple party witnesses struck?
All of the representatives from Aetna were struck. Everyone was struck.
They're not parties of the court.
And the defendant who had been named. They're not
parties. They're employees or officers.
Right. The corporate representatives. So it's a little bit, there's a distinction between the Smith versus Southwest Feed. The defendant, the primary defendant, Joe Haynes, was also named as a fact witness, who was a partner in Sanger and Offiel. He was also struck. They were well identified. The witness that who signed interrogatories and was listed as a witness was struck. This court is in a position of balancing the effects of Rule 215 and Rule 162. If there needs to be a clarification of the effect of sanctions after a non-suit, that needs to come from the rule. As the rule is now, it says non-suit does not affect sanctions that are pending. These sanctions were not pending. They were not properly reinforced in the second suit.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument. The second call. The court will take another brief recess.
Please rise.